Thank you for joining us today. I'm Scott Schiff, hosting the Atlas Society Senior Scholar Richard Salzman, doing an Ask Me Anything. Richard, thanks so much for doing this, and we want these to be interactive, so please raise your hand to join us. I've got questions from Instagram users, and I have a few myself. I didn't know if you wanted to start off a little bit with some comments of the day. I'm proud to call you a Facebook friend, so I saw a couple of your posts about Manchin Schumer.
Yeah.
So the
question is what?
You know, they're talking about doubling the number of IRS agents.
Yeah. Right. Well, one of the points I made in the Facebook post was, this is a 10-year deal, apparently. You can never trust these numbers, actually, when they project. But the entire thing is proposed to be something like $800 billion. So that's at least $80 billion a year. But over the course of this time, $80 or $85 billion is dedicated to increasing the number of IRS agents, among other things. Now, it actually includes a doubling. I don't know the actual number of agents, but a doubling is really something. And the point I made was that is obviously not a number necessary, you know, to go after so-called fat cats, although even if it was, that wouldn't be just to target, you know. It's to go after a mass number of people, and I've often thought that a sign of a crooked or wrecked fiscal system is that you see enforcement go up in the face of tax avoidance and evasion. Tax avoidance and evasion occur because the tax burden's excessive. Whatever the philosophy of people is, you know, whatever they consider fair government burdens to be, if they're evading and avoiding is legal and evading is not, it's a indicator of a problem. But the solution to that is not to get to sick more IRS pit bulls on people. It's to lighten the burden. Now, if you back into this, even today, the tax burden doesn't fully pay for the spending. One of the reasons the government borrows so much, one of the reasons it prints so much money, is that those are alternatives to taxing. So already, people vote for a level of government spending that they are not willing to pay for in taxation. And politicians know this, of course, and they know that there can be tax revolts. There have been in the past. So that's just my take on that. This is obviously not the way to go. It's an unjust thing. The IRS itself only exists because there's an income tax. But the idea of making it more brutal and invasive and to weaponize it, everyone knows it's going to be used selectively as well. Years ago, it was used to go after Tea Party groups. So that is just one piece of the $800 billion. This is just, that's like one-tenth of this monstrosity of Manchin Schumer bill, the tax side. So I just want to name kind of the philosophic fiscal aspect of that, which is terrible. The other thing is it's partly Green New Deal. I mean, the Green New Deal was voted on and rejected a few years ago as the monstrosity it was, but this one has about a third of the spending is on Green New Deal type stuff. So they're kind of doing what was done when Hillary in the early 90s tried to get what amounted to later to be Obamacare, and that wasn't passed, but they just did it incrementally. So I think it's a testament to, if you have a principle in mind and you have a goal in mind, as these anti-capitalists do, we can learn something from this, because they name the principle, and then they're searching and looking for any opportunity to advance the ball down the field. You know, they're not necessarily looking for a Hail Mary pass into the end zone. They'd love that, but if they can't get that, they'll take 10 yards and set up the play again. So that's happening as well. Manchin is just a complete sellout. Why anyone on the right would have thought that he'd be a reliable Democrat holding out against the craziness. He was basically bribed. He was bribed with something which I don't think will actually happen. He was bribed with the possibility of a natural gas pipeline out of West Virginia going into Virginia. And that requires regulatory approval. And I don't know why he believes Schumer could promise him that. But it's clearly a fossil fuel type thing. And the whole point of the Green New Deal, the whole point of the Biden regime, is to be against fossil fuels. So the whole thing is just a craziness and more reckless spending. And notice, amidst a recession, I mean, they're officially, technically in recession now, And this package not only includes still more reckless spending, but includes tax hikes on corporations. The last time I remember a president advocating tax hikes during a recession was Hoover, who did it in the 1932 period and turned a recession into a depression. So that's just my take on Manchin. Schumer, I don't think it's been passed yet, so there's still some opportunity for people to oppose this. If you have any influence, try to oppose it.
Well, that was great commentary, a whole deep vein we could go down. But now I want to allow for some other questions. Roger, thanks for joining us.
Hey, what's up, Richard? What's up, Scott?
Hi, Roger.
We had a room yesterday on Clubhouse titled simply Altruism, and the room went on for 16 hours. And I was really hoping that somewhere along the line, some of the scholars would awaken and join the room. So us lay folk were talking about this topic, and I wanted to kind of throw out my position and then a question on altruism. So when it comes to the definition of altruism, I question whether it even exists, because it's basically this idea that you're doing something selflessly for others. And I struggle to come up with an idea of something that you can do or that you would do that wouldn't have some benefit to yourself. And if there is some benefit, then it's not selfless, and therefore it would be it would negate the idea that there is altruism. And I know Rand's take on it is that it's evil. And so as we went through the conversation, we were kind of bouncing around a few different ideas. And I do have a question here, but I want to throw this out there. If altruism, egoism, and utilitarianism are all under this umbrella of consequentialism, which essentially is stating that it's the consequence that we're going to measure to determine whether something that has moral value, and then you have to look at a different ethical framework of deontological ethics to say if something is morally right simply because of the behavior and not necessarily the result. I would argue that if somebody did something for someone else because they thought it was the right thing to do, we're not measuring the outcome, and it still wouldn't be altruism, because that would be from a framework of deontological ethics. And so I guess my question after saying all of this is, what do you think Rand's take of altruism being evil versus maybe a consensus that we arrived at after 16 hours of talking about this topic, that we don't believe that altruism exists? What do you think Rand would say to that, and what do you say to that?
Well, I don't want to speak for her, but she's written volumes on this, but she did accurately convey the view of it coined by the coiner of it, which is Auguste Comte, C-O-M-T-E, a positivist Frenchman who in the early 1850s coined the term. And altruism meaning alter, other, it's literally other-ism. And he was trying to counter egoism, and he was trying to come up with a secular, not a religious, by the way, a secular ethic to counter egoism. So he himself conceived of it as the opposite. I wouldn't say it's opposite in the sense of the Nietzschean view as egoism is sacrifice others to self, and Comte was advocating sacrifice of self to others. But that is definitely what he said, and to the point where he said, if you serve others and get pleasure out of it, that doesn't count. So altruism meant not only service to others, but service to others didn't mean anything to you. So it could be shorn of any, this is a Kantian, as you can tell, shorn of any self-interest or desire. But then also a real test of it would be if you suffered from the act, then you could tell no happiness. Or if it was an enemy, Christ said, turn the other cheek to the enemy. So that would be a test of it. Now, it's true that over time, Roger, maybe what you're referring to and maybe what came up in the room is, over time, the connotation of altruism came down to benevolence, charity, just being kindly toward others. But if you understand what self-sacrifice is, people do engage in self-sacrifice. So you don't want to get into the semantics here. You don't want to just dismiss it as, well, I've never seen anyone, most people are benevolent, so let's just call it altruism and let's make the whole thing murky. I think terms matter. This term is specifically easily anchored in the person who coined it. And I think Ayn Rand was right to hone in on it and denounce it as evil. Evil from the standpoint of any kind of sacrifice is animalistic. It's not human. The idea of humans sacrificing themselves or sacrificing others is fundamentally anti-human. And a destruction of values, or at least a surrendering of values, but also a destruction of values. But the idea that why not, if benevolence and charity, as David Kelly and others have pointed out, is perfectly rational, selfish motives, should not be package dealed with self-sacrifice. And I think that's part of it. It's worth distinguishing. I shouldn't have to name all the cases of self-sacrifice. The Germans sacrificing themselves to the Nazis, the Soviets sacrificing themselves. I mean, even specific cases like Jim Jones cults and things like that happens all the time. Another way of looking at this would be to say, if you said, well, no one can be completely self-sacrificing because they would die in a minute. That's true. That's true. But that is one of the reasons altruism's main goal, you could say, or the advocates of it, is to instill guilt and to spread the concept of hypocrisy, that a moral code can't be practiced consistently. And so then you have widespread guilt and widespread hypocrisy. That is no way to live life, and it's certainly the source of evils as well. If you wanted to just make it in a physical form, suppose someone said, human well-being benefits by food, but not by poison. And you could mix food and poison and still survive. Well, yes, you could. And then if you said, well, but no one takes poison straight out without food. Well, no, they do actually. Sometimes people poison others or take poison to engage in self-sacrifice. So it should be kept separate. They are mixed. That there's no doubt about it. But the fact that you can name a mix, I think, means you can name the distinguishing feature. So I hope that's not too long an answer. But I think the worst kind of stuff that comes out of these kind of debates is if it's left with, well, altruism just sounds like being nice to others. And even if it's self-sacrifice, nobody does it all the time. So there's no problem here. I think that's a real problem.
Thanks, Richard.
Thanks, Roger. That's a good question.
Thank you, Lawrence.
Hello. So, Richard, I had a question from your economic standpoint. You know, there's been talk of gas prices going down a little bit, and I know the Biden administration was quick to say it was their releasing of the strategic oil reserves that did it. And while I very much doubt that, there has been a drop. So I'm curious, is this more of just the demand is starting to go down because people aren't willing to pay the high prices, or if you had any sort of idea of why gas prices are starting to go down all of a sudden?
Well, that's a good question. You can never say all of a sudden why some specific thing happened. But if you resort always to the principle of supply and demand, this thing is important to recognize because it's not common among, say, non-econ students. If you say, what are prices that determined by? Most people know it's just supply and demand. But there's a counter loop, there's a feedback loop in the sense that prices themselves will determine supply and demand. And you just named one of them, Lawrence. If people see prices going up, they will conserve their demand, they will demand less. Economists call it quantity demand, it goes down. But likewise, a higher price brings more supply. So the running statement in economics is the cure for higher prices is higher prices. You know what I'm saying? Namely, it brings down the demand and boosts the supply, which all else equal brings the price down. So that's part of it. The overall reason for rising commodity prices, the more broad macro reason, not supply-demand within the marketplace, but the broader one, is inflation. That's why not just energy prices, but food prices, housing prices, and other prices have gone up broadly. And the word inflation usually pertains to a broad rise in all prices, and caused by depreciation in the value of money, by creating too much money. So if you see prices coming down, it not only was not a Putin price hike, it wasn't a Putin price cut. All of a sudden, greed went away over the last month and the gas stations were no longer greedy. All the stupid, silly stuff that was said a month ago. If that were true, yes, you'd have to reverse all of them and come up with these goofy explanations. But higher prices do curb quantity demanded and invite quantity supplied. Now, the Biden administration is trying to stop and has successfully stopped as much as possible supply. But Russia and others are producing supply. Of oil and gas. So elsewhere in the world, of course, there's an enormous motivation if there's no restrictions on producing oil and gas, as there is not in Russia and elsewhere. There's a flood of oil and gas coming out of there. And notice OPEC is starting to produce more now. Yeah, because the price is so high, it's very profitable to produce.
Got it. Thanks. I was curious because, here in Houston, I know a lot of the oil and gas companies are seeing the rise and they're trying to ramp up their production. I know a lot of the projects, at least locally here, that they're looking more 3, 4, 5 years down the line. So I was curious of the more change now. And I think that's a good explanation. Thank you.
By the way, there's a parallel to, this may say completely unrelated, but there's a parallel to gun control. Everyone knows that after there's a mass shooting and they start dickering with gun control, that people rush out and buy guns, right? They rush out and buy guns in anticipation of having gun sales restricted. And the gun controllers get the opposite of what they intended, right? They get more guns out there, not fewer. And the same thing with these greenies. They want to banish fossil fuels precisely to the extent they restrict it. They raise the price of these fossil fuels. And it's true that people would curb their demand, but they forget that the suppliers of fossil fuels will want to provide more of them. So they defeat their own purpose in that regard.
Great. Thank you. Iris, welcome to the stage. We also have TAS founder David Kelly with us. Iris, go ahead.
Hi. Good evening from Tel Aviv. Richard, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the gas, the gas situation and oil. We see since like the Russian-Ukrainian war, we see a lot of countries trying to come up with alternative to send gas to Europe. I'm from Israel, and one of the things that you probably heard about is the joint venture of Israel with Egypt and cut through Qatar to get the gas to Europe. I wonder what your take is on that. We talked about it like a few weeks ago, but how do you see it? Do you see those things happening? Do you see any complicated situation that will not, make it happen? I just wonder. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Iris. The European situation in terms of the Green New Deal, they have been, in Germany and elsewhere, have been pursuing that policy mix for many years now, many decades now. And they have tried to increase the proportion of power generated by what they call renewables, what I and Alex Epstein and others called unreliables, solar, wind, biomass. And at the end of the day, they're learning that they can't keep the lights on. They can't keep the air conditioning going. They can't keep the factories running. So you brought up Russia, Ukraine. Instances like this highlight the problem of doing that. And Europe is recoiling now at the idea of they don't have enough oil and gas. They're being forced by NATO and others to repel imports, from Russia and elsewhere. And, push comes to shove, they just do not have the capacity to replace oil and gas with these other alternatives. So you're seeing some of them starting to buckle on this. Germany is starting to commission the reopening of certain fossil fuel plants. France is a case where they've relied on nuclear energy, which is smart. But as you know, the environmentalists are generally against nuclear energy as well. My theme and for many years has been they're trying to starve capital of the energy it needs. So if their concern is not really with emissions, greenhouse gas emissions or climate change, because if that were true, they would be all for nuclear. They're not for nuclear. They're anti-nuclear and anti-fossil. So they're solely focused on and reliant on and wishing for a pre-industrial energy mix. That's what wind, solar, and biomass are. Those are the only energy sources we have today that still existed prior to the Renaissance. So they are truly pre-modern and pre-industrial in that regard. I don't think this will last very long, in the sense of, I don't think, by last, I mean, I don't think Europe and others will all of a sudden come around to appreciating and fighting for fossil fuels. I think this is just a temporary thing. And when the price of fossil fuels comes down again, they'll revert to pushing green again. But it's very difficult to resist voters who see the lights go out. I think that's highly likely in the U.S. soon. If it isn't happening already, there are rolling blackouts and brownouts in the West. So it's when voters begin to see the actual practical results of the Green New Deal that there's some political pushback, but there's no philosophic pushback or defense of fossil fuels other than a very small minority.
Great.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your answer.
Thank you. David, thank you so much for joining us. Do you have a question for Richard?
Well, I just wanted to jump into that conversation that Roger began about egoism and altruism, which is an issue of philosophical ethics. It looks like Roger has left the room, so I'm not sure it's relevant, and I don't want to interrupt the flow of economic insight that Richard's providing. Let me just say, the issue of whether any action is truly altruistic is a thesis of what's often called psychological egoism. Everyone acts out of for something that they want. But most philosophers, not just objectivists. I mean, this is regarded as a non-starter, as an ethical view, because what it says is that every action is motivated. Well, yeah, that's a tautology. The question is, what's it motivated by? And it can be motivated by your goal of benefiting yourself or benefiting others. That's a basic distinction, not the most fundamental in ethics, but a basic one. And, so the question is not, do you get something out of being altruistic? Of course you do, in the sense of if you're an altruist, you have a motive. You want to feel good about it. You want to do something that you think is right. We all, self-esteem and a sense of self-worth is one of our values. But the question is, how do you define, what is your standard of self-worth? What is your standard of value? And on that count, altruism and egoism are just opposing substantive views. You can't reduce it to just a kind of simple doctrine. If Roger were here, I'm sure this must have come up in the 16-hour conversation he was describing. But I just want to make that point, and then we can get back to the economics.
No, I'm glad you made that point, David. I've often thought, I wonder how would you interpret this? When I discuss psychological egoism with people, it strikes me that view, is this true, David, in the philosophy departments, that in effect takes it out of the realm of choice? But psychological egoism sounds to me like, your heart pumps regardless of whether you want it to pump or not. And if so, then it isn't even a moral argument. Whereas ethical egoism says you should pursue your self-interest, but you have to choose to do so. You have to learn how to do so. And that's not really true with psychological egoism, right? So it strikes me as a contradiction in terms, or oxymoronic in some way, to hold that position, psychological egoism, that we have this instinct for self-preservation. Well, if so, then you don't get any credit or demerit for doing it, right? Is that accurate or not?
It is accurate, Richard. It's what we one element of the problem is that you're defining self-interest. You're defining what is in your interest in just terms of desires, subjective states, including, yeah, you know, your desire to feel good about yourself. Yeah. And but the whole point of ethics is to help us understand, you know, what actually supports life, what actually is good, and yeah, to what extent should we include others in our lives. And that's where the distinction between benevolence and altruism comes in. So I'm glad you mentioned that. But there's a whole package of bad assumptions, I think, behind psychological egoism. But one of them is that, well, if you say it's not an issue, then it's not an, it, then you're saying it. In fact, it's an automatic reflection.
Right. And right,
that there's no choice involved. So that's another problem.
There's I know in the literature, on literature on charity, on benevolence, on giving and things like that, there's a concept which doesn't sound so technical, but they actually call it the warm glow feeling that people get. This is actually in social science literature, David, that they get from engaging in, assume these are altruistic acts, right? Well, even that sounds selfish, right? What do you mean? You mean you feel good about yourself? You feel a warm glow? Oh, I've given to the United Way or something like that. On Auguste Comte and Immanuel Kant's view, that's still selfish. But also the key is they're saying, well, I desire it, and as long as I have a good feeling, so feelings come into the analysis, right? We no longer have a scientific ethic. Now we're just saying, well, everyone does whatever they desire to do, as if desire is the legitimating factor, which we reject.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, as a kid, if you're a kid in school, you know what the right thing to do is, you know, not to shoplift, but your peers are shoplifting. You might feel an anxiety that I'm not part of the group, so you shoplift, right? And to alleviate your anxiety. It's an unethical act, but you feel better. You're still part of the gang, right? Now, no one would say that that's ethical, and yet you feel better. You feel better than if you were ostracized from the gang. Anyway, well, thank you, David.
An even more extreme example, you know, sadists apparently feel good in imposing pain on other people.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
So anyway, all right. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you, David. Helpful.
All right. Good. Well, I go ahead. I'm sorry. Did you have something to add?
No.
Okay. Well, we invite people to share the room, also to raise your hands if you want to get in on this and ask Professor Salzman a question. I've got a list here from Instagram. This one is kind of interesting. Why is gold and silver less shilled than cryptocurrency lately?
Why is it less what?
Shilled.
What is it? Oh, you mean promoted?
To kind of sell it, you know.
Oh, why is it... Okay, so there's a negative connotation in there. I wouldn't know how to answer that. You know, people who sell or market these things. Bitcoin and crypto are definitely the new thing. So they're exciting and interesting from that standpoint. People are just trying to figure out what they are and what their prospects are. Of course, there's some downside. Bitcoin and the cryptos have lost something like 70% of their value. But that alone interests people from the standpoint of, well, is it a bubble but popping now? Or is it just another opportunity to buy? I'm more optimistic about Bitcoin and crypto than that. But, you know, gold and silver have been around for a long time. Everybody knows their value in terms of preserving purchasing power. And I guess the only other thing I would say is their price action, quote unquote, in the last 5 years has been almost nil. Actually, one of the great beauties of gold and silver that they have this stable purchasing power. But if you just charted gold and silver versus not only the S&P, those are equities, and the cryptos, they've had a very steady value. And they're just, from an investment standpoint, I suppose, there's just not as much interest in those two when they're not, you know, going up 1,000% every day or every year.
There are, you know, conspiracy theorists that believe that any kind of potential inflation hedge is being suppressed by central banks to stop them. And so, you know, I mean, it seems like neither gold nor Bitcoin has gone up as inflation has reared its head.
Well, gold has gone up in the last decade. It doesn't go up or down with the CPI, that's for sure. But over the long run, you can't get a long inflation without a big increase in the gold price. So the two tend to go over time, they tend to go up and down together. So if people are interested in this, I think philosophically, not marketing wise, but philosophically, the most interesting debates I've seen going on in money is Bitcoin versus gold versus fiat. I don't call it fiat money. I call it fiat tokens, the dollar. Whether Bitcoin shares the properties of gold or not at all. And so in terms of the three types of money out there, the fiat monies, gold, and Bitcoin, there's an interesting debate because people in the Bitcoin community tend to lean libertarian, not all of them, but some of them tend to lean libertarian in terms of the philosophic case for it. And they want to, but they want to move beyond gold as a kind of fuddy-duddy old clunky system that no young person would dare defend anymore. Only old people like me and would defend the gold standard. So it's interesting from that standpoint because there is some common talk between Bitcoin people and gold people like me. So
okay, that's fair. JP, welcome to the stage. Do you have a question?
Thank you, Scott. Thank you for having me. Yes, I have a question for Richard. It's something that came up after a room that somebody else did on altruism last night. And they were going on and they were not even really taking it from a philosophical perspective. And so I stopped and I just listened. But it got me to thinking that altruism is... would you say that it's safe to say that altruism leads to collectivism? And is it too daring to say that they're interchangeable?
Well, I wouldn't say they're interchangeable because altruism is the ethical code and collectivism is a bridge to the political. You know, collectivism versus individualism is the setup. And then the forms of collectivism would be statism would be the political manifestation, and then there's various kinds of statist regimes, from fascist to communist to socialist. But definitely altruism breeding collectivism. If the high virtue and the noble virtue is to serve others, well, who would those others be? Others in groups, usually, or groups retain the power of saying, well, we as a group have more power than the individual. Altruism basically says the individual is nothing. The individual is a servant of a master, right? The whole servant-master setup is the servant is subordinate, right? So that alone, there's many other factors here, but that alone might help you see why altruism must necessarily lead to collectivism, which is the idea that the collective can subordinate, should subordinate the individual to the group. So that is one way of looking at it. The other way is looking at it is the collective collects the sacrifices. People forget that when they're self-sacrificed, the other side of the ledger, if you will, is that someone's collecting the sacrifices. Ayn Rand once said, how come the collectors of the sacrifices are never defined as selfishly, greedily collecting the benefits that others are bestowing to them? But that's just as a hypocrisy argument against them. I should say also, it might add to the conversation we had before, JP, it sounds like you're referring to the Roger room where they went on for 16 hours about this, that altruism is incompatible. I shouldn't just say that its connotation has now become benevolence, charity, kindliness toward others. Nathaniel Brandon many years ago wrote an essay called Altruism Versus Benevolence, a very insightful essay showing that not only are they not, shouldn't be seen as interchangeable, but that altruism makes benevolence and goodwill among men impossible. It makes them distrust each other. It makes them expect either to eat or be eaten. And so it's incompatible with benevolence. So that makes it one of that's one of the weirdest things going on is that if to the extent people think altruism means benevolence, What if they were to learn that, no, it actually leads to distrust and malevolence? So I'll leave that there.
Thank you. That just opened my mind so much. And I want to thank Scott and the Atlas Society for recording these things, but because I have known to be replaying them to take notes. It's so much depth is transmitted here that, and I thank you for this opportunity.
Thanks, JP. Spread the word to tell people about the society. Thanks.
Glad to hear it. Yeah, maybe some of that altruism leading to anger has a role in our polarization today. But Price, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you. Actually, I've got a question, which to me has been, you know, I've turned around in my mind for decades. It's basically like the environmental question. I mean, the thing that gets me is I just don't see how, to me, it seems like it's problematic. You know, what do they call it? The tragedy of the commons, right? If nobody owns it, then everybody dumps on it. But the flip side is you can never really have self-regulation. And so what comes to mind is like fracking, right? So in other words, I'm not trying to argue that there aren't issues of regulatory capture or that there aren't issues of corruption within the state trying to regulate things. But the flip side is if I have a property upstream, or for that matter, just, you know, in a way that if I start fracking 100 miles away and then it ends up leaching into some other person's well that is that 100 miles away, what sort of, you know, how does the market deal with that without some sort of enforcement or regulatory mechanism? And is it seems to me that the downstream person's property rights and their ability to live is being infringed upon by the other person who's, hey, I'm just fracking on my property. What are you talking about? Well, unfortunately, you know, we all know when it gets to the underground, there aren't any property lines that you can stop that sort of damage.
Good question, Price. The examples you gave, I notice, assumed private property. So that's good. But the tragedy of the commons argument was that, and it is a tragedy, that when property is commonly held, it's badly treated and dissipated and things like that. So that's well known. Basically part of the reasons why communism fails utterly. But the examples you gave are handled, when you say, how does the market handle that? Capitalism, of course, is not anarchy. It does have government, and one of the legitimate of the three government functions beyond defense and police is courts. And then the courts are not only criminal but civil, and I think what you're talking about is civil remedies. But that's what torts are. I mean, tort, a T-O-R-T, a tort, not a desert, but a wrong inflicted on another. You go to court over these things. Now, some of these things could be handled outside of court. If property rights are being violated, the property owners can deal with each other and try to accommodate each other. It's not necessary that everyone go to court, but that is the fundamental answer to what you're asking, is it's handled in civil courts. People go with evidence of a material harm. I'm using words that lawyers will know is in the legal code. It can't just be any nitpick. It has to be material harm, demonstrable, that kind of thing. And if it isn't, then you don't have a settlement. But I would also stress that you mentioned regulation and regulatory capture. I'm going to be doing a session later this month on regulation. Regulations are improper and at odds with the tort and commercial civil code system because they presume guilt. The regulatory agency approach of setting up, say, the EPA or the FTC or the FDA, the whole alphabet agencies, when they write rules, they are assuming someone will do harm and engaging what the Supreme Court on First Amendment cases has called prior restraint. And in First Amendment cases, they've rejected prior restraint limits, you know, on the presumption that the New York Times will libel or slander someone. You can't do that. You have to wait until they libel or slander someone and then take them to court. So I say the same thing should happen in the commercial realm. It has not happened for years. The regulatory state began in the 30s and so has, in that regard, displaced in some degree the civil court system. But that, in a pure capitalist system, the civil remedies would handle what you're talking about
Okay, could I ask a follow-up then? So what happens if...
Sure.
Okay, so this is my problem with that. That sounds good, but to me it's a utopian scheme. Because what happens when I'm the person down... What happens when I'm the person downstream and I sue the guy at, you know, Megacorp Fracking upstream, and then I sue him for, let's say, oh, I don't know, $10 million, which I consider to be, you know, that you poisoned my groundwater, you screwed my farm over. Well, what happens when Fracking International says, you know something, hey, we're only a $1 million operation. Sorry, buddy, we're out of business, and now, you know, we're back in Dubai or wherever, and you can go screw yourself.
Well, first of all, I would reject the idea that what I described is just sounds nice and is utopian, because the civil court system has been going on for centuries. I mean, billions and billions of dollars of settlement have been handled in practical terms day to day through the common law and elsewhere. So it's not just some utopian dream. It happens every day. These settlements occur. Now, in a case of what you're talking about, I mean, if you sue someone and for a legitimate amount that they can't afford, that's a problem. That's obviously a problem. But I don't think that invalidates the whole system. That seems like an exception to the case. And in the court systems, in the civil systems, you remind me actually that there's not just compensatory damages, but punitive. So judges and juries will look at the case and say, was this just an accident where this company spilled, effluent on somebody else's property, or did they do it deliberately? So just as in criminal cases where they make distinctions in murder cases between first, second, third degree based on intent, and malice aforethought in First Amendment cases, that this is also true in tort cases. So that's the only answer I could give you, Price, as to how that would be handled. I mean, if the company goes out of business, that's the ultimate punishment. Whether it's a full remedy for the victim, that's always going to be a problem.
Good stuff. Thank you for that. John, thank you for joining the stage.
Yes, thank you. Again, going to Price's comment, the problem historically is issue of proof. That is, you're downstream of somebody upstream who's dumping effluents in a river, and it kills the fish that you're living off of, or the shellfish, or whatever it is. You can't irrigate your crops. The problem in the past has been one of scientific proof. Or indeed, there was a time when courts did not accept expert witnesses, going back, say, 100 years. And so it's always been an issue of the expense of gathering the proof and the possibility of sufficient proof. And that was the opening for the politicians to jump into the middle and tell the industry, the polluter, one thing, I'll sell you protection, and to tell the public another, oh, we'll protect you from the problem. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, John. I would just quickly, not to belabor this too much, but I would just quickly say, I don't believe that is I understand what you're saying, but I don't believe that is from my history, knowing the history of the regulatory state, if you will, that is not the origin of it. The origin was not, these tort cases are so difficult to demonstrate a demonstrable harm. Therefore, let's have, you know, the 1700 alphabet agencies we have today. I think the regulatory state results from all the things that lead to the greater state overall, the welfare state included, altruism, collectivism, issues of injustice, issues of that's a monopoly company, therefore they're inherently going to harm me, let's restrain them in advance. If the problem was what you mentioned, that could have easily been handled in the court system. Think of all the, put it this way, compare murder cases, say, in 1900 versus now. There's very many other complicated ways to murder people now that there didn't exist in 1900. Does that mean the court system can't handle murder cases? No. So complications arise. I would think it's even more. I would think today it's easier to demonstrate, but by better measurements and things like that, the harms people do to us, not the other way around.
Look, I agree with much of what you said. And of course, there are other motivations and interactions that result in the regulatory state. But speaking as an attorney, I can tell you that there's no history of what was going on in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, when people went to an attorney and said, we want to sue the copper smelter upriver. And the attorney said, well, yeah, everybody knows it, but I can't prove it. I can't, there's no such thing. If we got an expert that would testify to that, his testimony would not be allowed in the courts because that's the law at this moment in time. We don't allow expert testimony. So it has to do with there's a history of the law involved also.
Yeah.
And then you also had the legislators getting involved. For instance, when they wanted to regulate the railroads, the railroads just bought off the politicians. And well, they created the Interstate Commerce Commission in order to get away from state court judgments.
So I think in a capitalist court, the fact that you're naming things like expert testimony, which does exist, now maybe it didn't fully exist or wasn't fully allowed previously, but it should have been. I mean, obviously, expert testimony, as things get complicated, as measurements get difficult, you have expert testimony in murder cases, blood specialists and things like that. And also, here's another one, class action suits. I mean, the idea that, well, the singular individual cannot stand up against Exxon. And no, there are class action suits. If Exxon has in some way or harmed a broad swath of people, we have class action suits. So I'm not against class action suits. If that increases the opportunity for those wronged to get class remedies.
Class action.
John, I do want to get Prashant in here a little bit.
Excuse me. Class actions are a recent innovation. They didn't exist.
They're consistent with Cal. Yeah. I'm just saying expert testimony, class action suits are.
Right.
If the question is, are these compatible with capitalism in handling tort? I would say yes, they are.
Of course. Agreed.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, John.
Great. Thank you. Prashant, thanks for joining us. Do you have a question for Richard? You have to unmute with the bottom right microphone button. While Prashant is figuring that out, we have a question from Inai about why is everyone so worried about global supply chain issues?
Well, because they've been ruptured to a serious degree in places. One of the things, for those who don't know, global supply chain is simply the idea that just because something is manufactured, say in India, if it's to be delivered to a home in La Jolla, there's a long chain of distribution from the factory to the recipient. And that's called the supply chain. And I think one of the, and it was largely disrupted by the, I wouldn't say by the Wuhan virus itself, but by the maniacal policy response to the Wuhan virus, which was shutting down whole economies, sending people home and writing them checks. So, but one of the good things that came out of this, I think, is a recognition that there is such a thing as a global supply chain. I mean, people tend to think packages show up at their front porch and, were produced 3 days earlier somewhere in the neighborhood. The capitalist system, globalization generally, is a very intricate, complicated, interacting system, coordinated by the price system and the profit motive, thankfully, two things that people hate, or intellectuals at least hate. And the more advanced that becomes, the longer the chains are. We're not living literally hand to mouth, like a cave dweller. Hand to mouth literally means I pick the berries off the fruit and put it in my mouth. When you get an advanced system like this, you get the banana you ate today was, transported halfway across the world. How, and still affordable and still fresh and all that. It's amazing. And it's easily disrupted by stupid political policies. And then people literally can't get baby formula or they can't get this or that. And they're shocked to find, how come I can't get this anymore? Is it due to capitalism? No, it's due to wrecking the supply chain. So the other thing I notice, especially in energy, going the other way, denying or evading the supply chain, is these politicians who say, oh, we have a shortage of coal now, so let's agree to open up this coal plant for 6 months, and then we'll close it again. And then we'll open up the spigots in Saudi Arabia, and then we'll close them again. They're so in the central mode. They are so in the central planning mode of just being able to, with their whim, saying produce this or not, and give it to me in 6 months. They have, in that case, they have no idea about how long it takes to get the supply chains going and to get production going.
I mean, isn't that the real danger, that they seem to be driven by this carbon is so evil, we're just going to turn it on like a need to basis, and they're looking for ways not to have to?
Yes. I mean, apart from Wuhan breaking and disrupting the supply chains there, the whole assault, the whole war on fossil fuels is an ongoing, constant assault on supply chains, since energy supplies every other sector. So it isn't just, you know, pandemic related, that there's an underlying problem going on because of the assault on fossil fuels. But, you know, it's so complicated. People don't even think of this. You wouldn't think of supply chains in finance. There's massive supply chain disruption in finance because the Federal Reserve manipulates interest rates. Now, no one thinks of it that way because they don't think of packages coming to their front door from Amazon. But the same thing is happening, I've noticed, in finance. The wheels of finance are not moving as efficiently because governments are borrowing, taxing, and printing money and manipulating interest rates in ways that just isn't normal for a free-functioning system. So the supply, now this case not of tangible goods, but of credit and lending and things like that, is being disrupted all the time now. So it isn't just in the tangible sectors, it's also in these less tangible ones like finance.
Can I just jump in for a second, Richard? Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
The whole discussion about supply chains reminds me of that wonderful essay, I, Pencil, which I know you know, Richard. That was written in the 40s.
Yeah.
Even then, there's no human being who could produce a pencil from scratch.
Yeah.
You know, the elements of even such a simple thing came from all over the world. So anyway, just a reminder that this is, you know, supply chains are not a new phenomenon.
Right.
Thank you. I have one from Anush. He asks, is the dollar going to lose its reserve currency status?
Yes. And it already has eroded to some degree. Now, this is somewhat a technical term, but the fastest way to explain it is, if a currency has a reserve currency status globally, what that means is that it is so relatively trusted and believed in terms of its purchasing power, that other central banks hold the currency themselves as they issue their own currencies. In other words, they have reserves. That's why it's called a reserve currency. They themselves have reserves. It could be gold, it could be other currencies. And for the most part, they want to hold reserves that are reliable. So the dollar does have that role, and the way to measure it is you can pull up all the central banks and ask them what they're holding. And today, 60% of reserves are held in dollars. Now, it used to be 90%. So that's what I mean about erosion. Over time, that's been going down because the dollar is less and less trusted. It's being replaced by other currencies like the euro and other things. But just to give you some historical perspective here, at World War I, before World War I, 1913 or so, the reserve currency of the world was the British pound, not the dollar. The British had a reliable currency, and therefore other central banks held it. And the dollar was rising in its reputation because the U.S. was growing as an economy. And when Britain went into socialism and wars and things like that, the pound lost its reserve status and the dollar replaced it. So this can happen over time. It takes a long time for it to happen, but that's how the dollar displaced the British pound. And when that happened, the British pound lost value. It devalued many times. The British Empire shrunk. The economic vitality of Britain went away. So it's all of a piece. And that is what the U.S. is going through now. It's going through what Britain did 100 years ago. And what it will be replaced with, hard to say. I mean, it could be China's currency. It could be Russia just went on the gold standard. So it could be the ruble. But what it ultimately means is you have a much higher chance of getting higher inflation if you don't have a reserve currency. Because a reserve currency means other central banks are holding and demanding, wanting your currency. And that elevates the value of your currency, all else equal. You print a lot of it, but it doesn't lose value because others are holding it. So it's a supply and demand thing, right? But now, what, suppose that goes away. Suppose people say, we don't want to hold dollars. We don't trust dollars. Now the cascade of money printing is really problematical because there's less demand to hold dollars. If there's less demand for dollars but more supply of dollars, the value of dollars will go down, which is another way of saying the value of money will go down, which is another way of saying prices will go up, which is another way of saying inflation will go higher. So that the question's a good one. It's somewhat of a technical one, but it is relevant to whether the U.S. can continue to print money seemingly without limit, meaning without substantially higher price inflation.
Might other countries... Bitcoin? Go ahead. What about Bitcoin?
Do you believe that could be... I mean, I'm a Bitcoiner, so obviously I'm biased, but my personal belief is that that's a social innovation that Satoshi came up with and that Bitcoin has a good chance of becoming the world reserve currency.
Yeah, well, it might. That would take a long time, but it's possible. But remember that just as gold became that, if it's in the financial, if it's in the political interests of governments to ban a viable money, a truly viable money, and I'm just going to assume that Bitcoin might become that, they can ban it. They ban gold. I mean, you can own gold, but they banned it as a reserve. So, it comes down to politics ultimately. Bitcoin and gold themselves, gold has certainly demonstrated its capacity to be a legitimate money. There's no question there. Bitcoin's only 13 years old. It's not 1,300 years old. But that I think is the main risk with Bitcoin. Bitcoin is algorithmically beautiful and really well designed. I'm a big fan of it in that regard, but I'm not naive to know that to the extent it became worthy, that's precisely why governments don't want it around, or they'll co-opt it by issuing their own digital currencies. They don't want a competing money that is legitimate, at least in today's context of state of growing statism. So I agree with you on the technicals of Bitcoin, but it runs a political risk of being banned or restricted at some point.
Yeah, I got worried when I saw they were coming out with a central bank cryptocurrency. It's like once they have their own, they may not want competition.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a really good session, Richard. We appreciate it. You are going to be in Orlando this weekend, today through Saturday. You and Atlas Society CEO Jennifer Grossman at YAL's Liberty Revolution at the Gaylord Palms in Orlando. You'll be defending the morality of capitalism. Hopefully we'll get some video clips too.
Great, I'll see you there. I'm heading down there now. Yes, 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, I speak on the morality of capitalism before the group at Young Americans for Liberty. So I'm looking forward to that. It'll be great.
Good, good. And then next week, Tuesday at 4 p.m. on Clubhouse, Lawrence and I will be back for a happy hour on Should You Eat the Bugs, or whatever the next big thing is by then. And Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern, Rob Trzynski will be on Clubhouse discussing objectivism and futurism. A very topic that's probably going to be coming up for a while. So thanks again to everyone who joined us and participated, especially Professor Salzman. And we will see everyone next week.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you, David. Thank you,
everybody. Thank you. Thank you, Scott. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.